So we were just finishing up in chapter 6 of John, where we found that Jesus had spoken some very intense words, and many of the disciples turned away from him, continued to not follow him anymore. And so at that point, Jesus asked his apostles, so are you going to go away too? And Peter comes back with a wonderful reply. He says, Jesus, you're the one who has the words of eternal life. So no, we're not going anywhere. It's a wonderful reply. So from there, now we're going to go and begin in chapter 7 of John and pick up the account there. So in John chapter 7, we'll just start in verse 1, and there we read, after these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. A pretty good reason not to go there. Verse 2, now the feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. So in this verse here, it gives us a time frame that we're dealing with here. Chronologically, during the time of the year that the feast of booths would be, this is like the end of summer, late September. So end of summer, early fall. And this is one of the three major feasts that they participated in according to the law that was set up. According to Torah, there were three main feasts. Sometimes they're called pilgrimage festivals, because during these three festivals or feasts, the idea was that people would go to Jerusalem to celebrate them. And all of these three main festivals, they all commemorate something to do with when Israel came out of Egypt. And they also are associated with the harvest of different crops, those that come in earlier and then those that come in later. And they're all referred to as a time of rejoicing. These truly are meant to be festivals, a time of rejoicing, a time of thankfulness, a time of recognizing God's provision. And so what those three are is the one that takes place earliest in the year, it was called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that would be in the spring of the year. And what's associated with that is also the Passover. So unleavened bread, the word for that in the Hebrew is matzah, and the word for Passover or Pesach. And that, of course, is a remembrance or a commemoration of when the angel of death passed over the children of Israel, and therefore their firstborn were spared the death that took place in Egypt. And it was that first coming out of Egypt that would take place. It was unleavened bread because it was something that happened quickly and they had to go quickly. And it commemorates that whole event that took place there. Over time, a lot of times the Feast of Unleavened Bread just became called the Passover. And the Passover was not just a singular event, but rather that the whole week in which they were celebrating that time. The second one is called the Feast of Weeks, and that's because it took place 7 weeks after the events there of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And in Hebrew, it's called Shavuot, and that word itself just means sevens, because the word for week in Hebrew just comes the word for seven, because a week is what? 7 days. And so that is the feast that they would have then. That took place, like I said, 7 weeks after the other event, or depending on how you count the days, it counts up to 50 days. And that's where we get the word Pentecost, which means 50. So that also became a term for this feast that took place. It celebrated the wheat harvest and over time became a commemoration of the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. And then you have the week or the Feast of Booths, which takes place here at the end of September. This would be the final harvest of several crops. And then so there was the celebration of that. And the word booth, or now it's called, as it is in Hebrew, Sukkot. And that just means a booth. And so these are like small tent things that they were instructed to live in. You're to take branches from palm trees and other willows and stuff, and construct these booths that you were to stay in. And it was to remind you what it was like to live in the wilderness. And so it's both a sort of a humbling thing that, yes, we were left to live in these tents and these booths in the wilderness, but at the same time, God did provide for Israel. And so those were the three main feasts that they had, that they would be celebrating. And so now in this verse here, in verse 2, we're told that it's near the Feast of Booths. And it was one then where people would be going to Jerusalem. So now we'll continue on here in verse 3. It says, therefore his brothers said to him, leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works, which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers were believing him. So this sounds good at first, right? His brothers, so he's with his family. And they're saying, hey, go, let's go into Judea. Let's go to Jerusalem. Show the works that you're doing. And it's sort of meant in a way that, see, let everybody really see how great you are. But yet it's coming from a place where they don't believe him, believe in him, believe unto him. That idea that they recognize him as the Messiah. They're not there yet. And so quite an interesting family dynamic you have going on there, right? I think it's really interesting when you think back how there's that reference in Mark chapter 3, where Jesus was in a home and then his family, some of his family were outside, and it speaks about how they thought he lost his senses. So this was something Jesus had to deal with. His family was not fully on board with the program, but it doesn't say that he turns away from his family or anything else. It's pretty interesting when you see that. Now, if we go on to verse 6 here, we read, so Jesus said to them, my time is not yet here, but your time is always opportune. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come. Having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. So he tells his family, his brother says, okay, you guys go on up. I'm not going right now. And so he doesn't really say, well, I'm never going, but he says, now's not the right time for me to go. And he doesn't want to be traveling with his family. That would make things a little bit more obvious. Instead, he waits, and then he goes on his own. And then, as it says there, as if in secret. He's not trying to draw attention to himself. Why? Because there are people in Jerusalem who want to kill him. So, verse 11. So the Jews were seeking him at the feast and were saying, where is he? So now we're talking about, we're in Jerusalem, there's the feast, and people are looking for him. This is a great feast. They expect him to be there. They haven't seen him yet. They're on the lookout for him. Verse 12, there was much grumbling among the crowds concerning him. Some were saying, he is a good man. Others were saying, no, on the contrary, he leads the people astray. Yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews. And that would be the Jewish leadership that was there. Verse 14, but when it was now the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. The Jews then were astonished, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? So pretty interesting there how eventually Jesus does go up and he begins to speak about that. Back in verse 12, though, we do see the idea that, again, there's always this controversy about who Jesus really is. Some think he's the Christ, some think not so much. He's got people that are on his side and people that are unwilling to accept it. And but it is interesting that no one was speaking this. You know, they're in their little groups maybe saying it, but no one was really going out there publicly because they were concerned about what the Jewish leadership would say or could do to them. They wanted to know how this man had become learned. I think that's interesting. Jesus really always amazed those who heard him teach and recognized that he wasn't, you know, didn't have the proper education, and yet he spoke with authority and spoke with great knowledge. Reminds you when Jesus was a young man, or really still a child at the age of 12 when they went to Jerusalem, and he ended up sticking around at the temple. And it says how the teachers were amazed at his understanding. And that was quite a while before. So Jesus is really something when he's teaching and communicating. So what we're going to do now is we're going to skip the next 20 verses or so, just so we can move on along here, just as a little summation. we have this section where Jesus continues to reprove them in many ways, those people that are there. He's speaking to the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders. He says that they're not really keeping the law. And then it speaks about how they seek to seize Jesus. At some point, eventually, they send out it says officers, and it would mean the temple guard to seize him. And we'll see what happens with that later. He says that they're judging according to appearances. So there's just a lot of heaviness going on here, of confrontation in terms of the way Jesus is speaking about this. One other thing I wanted to comment on, when it talks about him going to the temple, we have to remember that the temple was like a whole temple complex. You had the main building of the temple where you had the Holy of Holies and the other sections that were a part of it that had to do with the sacrifices and things like that. And, from the center of that, you had expanding outward. You had these other courtyards that were there and ultimately really rather large courtyards that surrounded it. And it's interesting to note that the size of the entire platform, so to speak, of the temple complex would cover approximately 25 football fields, the way we can measure things. It gives you a better idea. So this is a large area. So even if half of that is taken up with these main building areas and the areas of the sacrifice and stuff, that provided large amounts of area where you just had these open courtyards. And it's those areas where we find Jesus, where he would have been teaching and communicating with others and meeting and things like that. So that's what it means when it says that he went to the temple. He wasn't going inside a building or anything like that. So what we're going to do then is pick this up in verse 37. So it's chapter 7, verse 37 is where we're going to pick things up. And it says, "Now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, 'If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water.' But this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for the Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified." So here we have this section where he's speaking these talks about not being thirsty. Reminds us back when we were in John chapter 6, where Jesus speaks and he says, "I'm the bread of life." He not only claims the idea of not being hungry, but also, again, of not being thirsty. In John 6:35, "He who believes in me will never thirst." There's that sense of life that's provided. The two essentials for life is food and water. You cannot live without them. And yet, when you believe on Jesus, then you don't thirst, meaning what? You will have life. And then it goes on to give this idea of this From the innermost being will flow rivers of living water. Water there being used to represent the spirit that would come. And spirit itself is so often representative and tied in with life. And it's not like there is like one specific verse from the Old Testament when it talks about the scripture there that identifies this, but rather there are places that you can go to that when you put that together, this is the idea that's being communicated. So we're not going to look at those now. The verses are in your notes. It's from Isaiah and Ezekiel and Joel. So we can look at that at some other point. Now we'll go on in verse 40 of chapter 7. Some of the people, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, "This certainly is the prophet." 41. Others were saying, "This is the Christ." Still others were saying, "Surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where he was born?" So a division occurred in the crowd because of him. So again, we're pointing out that people are they're having these different ideas of who Jesus is. The Gospel of John is here and it's pointing us to it so that we could believe that Jesus is the Christ. And these things Jesus is teaching and the things that he is doing is to, again, communicate the truth that he is God's anointed one. And as a result, some are believing it. Some aren't quite there. We're saying he's the prophet, taking us back to that section in Deuteronomy, right? Yahweh, your God, will raise you up a prophet. You shall listen to him. So, but not quite there, maybe, as that he's the Messiah. And yet others equate the two. If they're saying he's the prophet, then they're saying he is the Messiah. It's interesting that in verse 42, it's talking about, the Messiah is going to come from Bethlehem, not realizing that Jesus actually was from Bethlehem. So I think that's interesting there, how you get that little conflict there. They're saying, can't be Jesus, he's not from Bethlehem. And it's like, actually, he is from Bethlehem. Now verse 44. Some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. The officers then came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" Earlier in that section that we didn't read, it talks about how the Pharisees sent these guys out to bring him, to seize him, to arrest him. He said, "What happened? How come you didn't arrest him?" Verse 46, the officers answered, "Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks." Verse 47, the Pharisees then answered them, "You have not also been led astray, have you?" They're getting a little prickly there. They're concerned that Jesus is going to convince these men that to follow Jesus. Verse 48, "No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he?" And that's where you just really see an interesting point that, look, we're the leaders. We know what's what. We're not falling for this guy. No one else should either. Right? Verse 49, "But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed." Don't get swayed by the crowd. They don't know anything. They don't know the law. We know the law. There seems to be a certain amount of arrogance that we see here. And of course, the Pharisees are upset. Jesus is just coming at him and telling them where things are at. And they do not like it. But then in verse 50, we see this. It says, Nicodemus, who came to Jesus before, being one of them, said to them, "Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?" So they just accused sort of the people of not knowing the law. Well, here's Nicodemus. He does know the law. And he's asking this question to them, and they don't like it. Verse 52, and they answered him, "You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee." You're not from Galilee, are you? Of course, they know he's not. But again, they're upset. They're being accusatory towards him. And it is interesting. There's just this general sense, and we see that in other places, especially throughout the Gospels, that, you know, being from Galilee was sort of looked down upon. You weren't really like a true blue person there. You know, you weren't a true blue Jew, I guess, is what the idea would be, one who really was a follower of Judaism. You weren't, there was some, and that goes back to the history of that region. It goes through hundreds of years where you had the kingdom that, you know, David had and Solomon, and then it splits, and then you've got the northern kingdom and the southern. The northern kingdom does terrible. Eventually, it's vanquished by Assyria, and people are carried away, and so it becomes a region where it's much less thought of as being truly part of, you know, the promised land. The inhabitants come from all different places. And so even though you have good, faithful believers like Peter and Andrew and those in that region, and all, it's, they're still looked upon as being not quite as good as those from Judea. It's a fairly human thing, right? We always tend to find, you know, there's those people that live in that other place that aren't quite as smart or aren't quite as good as we are. And you see that thing happening here. Okay, the other thing that's interesting is that search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee. It turns out actually Jonah was actually from Galilee, and there could have been others. So even in their statements, you know, they're wrong, which is really interesting. So now as we get to verse 53, we're going to skip that and go all the way down to chapter 8, verse 12. And the reason we're going to do that is because these verses here from 7:53 through 8:11, they're not in most of the manuscripts. And most of our Bibles, most of the newer translations today will actually put this section in brackets or something like that, just to indicate that this is not part of the text. There were some manuscripts where it was found in the Gospel of Luke and that, but for us and what we're looking at, the simple thing here is just to skip this and go right to chapter 8, verse 12, which is what we're going to do. And here we have the significant verse that we've been leading up to. Verse 12, then Jesus again spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So here's just this great exclamation point of who he is. He is the light of the world. And as we see that word world throughout the Gospel of John especially, it's emphasizing what the sinfulness of the world, the darkness of the world. And yet he is the light. And we're going to see that here in the next few verses where there's just that contrast between light and darkness, between blindness and seeing. And that's why it said, here we see it again in verse 12, I'm the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. And I believe that word life there again is referencing that life and the coming age of the kingdom. That's the life that will be there. Jesus is that light that brings you into that life. The expression, I am the light of the world, is again where the pronoun is emphatic, I am the light of the world. The world there is that which is sinful and dark. And the word follow is more, better be translated accompany. And if you just think of it in a very physical sense, Jesus is the light. So when you accompany him, if you're walking down a road, you're not in darkness. Very simple. But of course, it's in a spiritual sense, it's much greater. We follow, we accompany Jesus, and then we're not in darkness, but we have the light of life. Now what I wanted to do is point out a couple of different sections in the Old Testament that speak to this idea of the association between the Messiah and light. And there are several places, we're going to look at a few of them, that I think are just pretty dramatic in terms of what they express. So here we have Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, we read, But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. Those people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a land, in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Again, darkness versus light. When it speaks of Zebulun and Naphtali, those are two of the tribes originally that inhabited the Promised Land, two of the 12. And this, they, where they lived was this area that at the time of Jesus would have been called Galilee. It's that northern part up near the Sea of Galilee and off to the east of there, that whole section. And here in the time of Isaiah, it was spoken of this gloom and this darkness, because this was an area that was being conquered by these foreign lands, and therefore there was gloominess, there was darkness, they were being defeated. And yet there's a day coming where there'll be this great light that will enlighten that area. And it is speaking prophetically about the coming of the Messiah. Then also we have here in Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1, we read, "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations." And in verse 6, "I am Yahweh. I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison." The imagery there is just so wonderful in a sense of, again, it's comparing the darkness with the light. And, you know, to open blind eyes, to bring people out of prisoners from the dungeon. I mean, think of dungeon. Again, it's dark, it's gloomy, okay? But again, there'll be this brightness. There'll be light. There'll be life. All of the things that are associated with it. And in Isaiah 49, we read, he says, "It is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." Now, in many ways, you can read that the my servant there is maybe speaking more about Israel, that Israel will be this great light to the nations. Certainly back in other parts of the Old Testament, we get that idea that Israel would be an example about people who truly loved Yahweh, the one true God. And yet we also see that Israel falls short of that goal. And yet it is in the rising up of this anointed one of God who would truly accomplish this mission. And so it is in reference to the Messiah. So when Jesus is saying, "I am the light of the world," we can then think about how he says, "I will also make you a light of the nations, so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." What a great, great verse there that is. So here we are back again in chapter 8, verse 12. And I wanted to read through some of these verses here. And we'll read verse 12 again. And we read, "Then Jesus again spoke to them, saying, 'I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life.' So the Pharisees said to him, 'You are testifying about yourself. Your testimony is not true.'" Verse 14, Jesus answered and said to them, "Even if I testify about myself, my testimony is true. For I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I am not judging anyone. But even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone in it, but I and the Father who sent me. Even in your law it has been written that the testimony of two men is true. I am he who testifies about myself, and the Father who sent me testifies about me. So they were saying to him, Where is your Father? Jesus answered, You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. So again, just pretty intense situation here between Jesus and the Pharisees. They're really sort of going at it. I can imagine, well, I can't imagine really what it would be like. It would be to be right there. You're standing there and following Jesus, and he's coming into the situation, and there's back and forth between Jesus and the Pharisees. It must have been really an intense time. So now we're going to skip some of these other verses, but during this it continues with this type of dialogue with the Pharisees. Jesus tells them they're from below. So things are still pretty intense. This is that section where he says the truth will make you free, and then the Son will make you free indeed. He goes on to say that you are of your father, the devil. So Jesus is not, you know, being sublime here. He's being straight to the point. They are in contradiction one to another. And then they accuse him of having a demon. And what's really interesting is that through the end of this, it points out that actually those who are around following this debate or discourse, many of them believed, and they're believing just based upon the words of Jesus here and the things that he is confronting these Pharisees with. And then, so what we're going to go now is to all the way to John chapter 8, 59. And this is sort of the result of all this dialogue that's been going on here. Verse 59 says, Therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. This one here almost seems more like, yes, it already spoke at the beginning of John chapter 7 that they want to kill him, but they're also many times they're afraid of the crowd. But here there's a situation where he just gets them so angry that they just want to pick up stones and just throw them at him. And yet Jesus is able to escape, which he often does. When it's not his time, he finds a way out. And so from there, now we're going to go to chapter 9, verse 1. So Jesus leaves the temple area. And it says in verse 9, As he was passing by, he saw a man blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Interesting when you think about it, that the only option they give Jesus, if this man's born blind, well, either his parents did something wrong or he did something wrong. Now, you got to admit, if you're born blind, it's sort of hard to think how you could be the one that did something wrong. I'm not sure how that would exactly work. But it turns out Jesus' response is basically, he sort of ignores the question. He doesn't answer it because really it's not about their parents being wrong or sinning, or it's not about the individual either. Verse 3, what we read there is Jesus answered, It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, when you read that just as it is, you can almost think, well, so God made him blind just so he could, you know, do something great. And that's really not the point here. There's really no reference to the cause of the man's blindness. Jesus is just stating the fact that God's going to display his work. There's a man born blind. God's going to do something. It has nothing to do with whether the parents sinned or the man sinned or God made him that way. He is that way. We live in a sinful world and a dark world and a world of sickness. And therefore, but in this situation, God is going to do a work. Verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. Verse 5, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So he expresses this declaration again. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. It is he who will, what? End the blindness, who will end the ignorance, who will end the darkness. And that's what he's going to do for this man here. So we read in verse 5. So now verse 6. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes. So he spits into his hand, adds some dirt, turns it into like a little clay, and puts it on the man's eyes. Okay. And he says to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Oh, what a wonderful miracle this is. And the reality of it is, we know, had nothing to do with the clay. It had nothing to do with the dirt. Had nothing to do with the pool of Siloam. It was God and it was Jesus doing this great work as the Messiah, declaring that he is the light of the world. And now a man who was born blind sees. What a great demonstration is here for him to show that he truly is that light in a much greater way than having a man who was blind see, because ultimately it's about that eternal light, that life to come where there will be no more sickness, no more darkness, none of those things. Now you can imagine that this turns out upsets the Pharisees. And you got to start to wonder about yourself. If you start getting mad at someone because they heal someone, you might not be thinking the right way. That's usually not a good way to go. One point of interest is that there are six events that, first I wanted to look at something real quick. Look at chapter 9, verse 14. Okay, and this is going to let us know a little bit about why they were upset, right? Verse 14 says, now it was a Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. And then verse 16, therefore some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. They were always very particular about this. Can't do things on the Sabbath. And Jesus got into trouble with them more than once. There's actually six events that are recorded where Jesus gets in trouble with the Pharisees because he did something on the Sabbath that they thought he shouldn't have done. One of those is when they went and they were going through the fields and they picked the grain. And then the other five were all healings. There was the healing of the man with the withered hand. There was the woman who was bent over. There was the man with, as it's called in many versions, dropsy. That would be swollen limbs, an edema type of situation. Then you had the crippled man at the pool of Bethesda. And then here we have the man who was born blind. So in this event, what Jesus does is he puts the clay on the man's eyes and he tells him, go to the pool of Siloam. So where is the pool of Siloam? Well, I've got a map here on the slide. And in it, this is showing what the city of Jerusalem looked like at the time of Jesus. The way it's shown there are different walls. It's the red line, if you can discern it, that it was showing the walls of the city at the time of Jesus. Very easy to see there up on the right side, a little bit towards the top, is the temple area. So that we can see as a city, that is a very large area. That's that complex that takes up, like I said, about 25 football fields. Now, if you were to go straight south or straight down from there into the bottom corner, that's where the pool of Siloam was. And that's quite a downhill trek. By the time you get to the pool of Siloam, just beyond that, you have the convergence of the valley, the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley sort of meet right there. And that's where the pool of Siloam is. So this man goes there. I can't help but think he probably had somebody help him to make that trek. And he goes all the way down. He washes in the pool of Siloam. He can see, and he comes back. And what a great day this is for this man. It's a wonderful day. And here is Jesus as light of the world, taking a man who was born blind, and now he's able to see. And as we go into the next section, we're going to see the response, not only of the Pharisees towards Jesus, but of the response that they give towards this man. And we're going to see how Jesus, again, comes forward as that Messiah in a different way to help this man. But I wanted to close this segment out by just mentioning a quote that I was thinking of as we read through this. C.S. Lewis is famous for this quote where he said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it," meaning the sun, "but because by it, I see everything else." It's such a great quote, because that really is true. Christianity as a whole, it is by Christianity that we can really see the truth, and then we see what everything else is going on. But how about if we apply that same thought to Jesus as the light of the world? So Jesus is not only that source of light whom we can see, but then it is through him that we can see everything else. As the Messiah, it is Jesus who explains the Father, as it's recorded in John 1, chapter 18. In John 14, 9, Jesus is able to say, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." He is making the Father known. We have seen the Father. We can understand the Father. And again, to reiterate, Isaiah 49, 6, "I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." What a great statement that is for Jesus to proclaim that he truly is the light of the world.